The Brodring Kingdom was the humans' country before the Riders fell. After Galbatorix killed Vrail, he flew on Illyria with the Forsworn and deposed King Angrenost, taking his throne and titles for his own. The Brodring Kingdom then formed the core of Galbatorix's conquests. He added Vrongard and other lands to the east and south to his holdings, creating the empire you are familiar with. Technically, the Brodring Kingdom still exists, though at this point I doubt that it is much more than a name on royal decrees. Afraid to pester the elf with further inquiries, Aragorn concentrated on his food. His face must have betrayed him, though, because Oromis said, "You remind me of Brom when I chose him as my apprentice. He was younger than you, only 10, but his curiosity was just as great. I doubt I heard aught from him for a year, but how, what, when, and above all else, why? Do not be shy to ask what lies in your heart."
"I want to know so much," whispered Aragorn. "Who are you? Where do you come from? Where did Brom come from? What was Morzan like? How, what, when, why? And I want to know everything about Vrongard and the Riders. Maybe then my own path will be clearer."
Silence fell between them as Oromis meticulously disassembled a blackberry, prying out one plump segment at a time. When the last corpuscle vanished between his port-red lips, he rubbed his hands flat together, polishing his palms, as Garrow used to say, and said, "Know this about me, then. I was born some centuries past in our city of Luthvira, which stood in the woods by Lake Tudostan. At the age of 20, like all elf children, I was presented to the eggs that the dragons had given the Riders, and Gleda hatched for me. We were trained as Riders, and for near a century we travelled the world over doing Vrail's will. Eventually the day arrived when it was deemed appropriate for us to retire and pass on our experience to the next generation. So we took a position in Illyria and taught new Riders, one or two at a time, until Galbatorix destroyed us."
"And Brom?"
"Brom came from a family of illuminators in Cuasta. His mother was Nelda and his father Holcomb. Cuasta is so isolated by the spine from the rest of Alagasia, it has become a peculiar place, full of strange customs and superstitions. When he was still new to Illyria, Brom would knock on a doorframe 3 times before entering or leaving a room. The human students teased him about it until he abandoned the practice, along with some of his other habits. Morzan was my greatest failure. Brom idolized him. He never left his side, never contradicted him, and never believed that he could best Morzan in any venture. Morzan, I'm ashamed to admit, for it was within my power to stop, was aware of this and took advantage of Brom's devotion in 100 different ways. He grew so proud and cruel that I considered separating him from Brom. But before I could, Morzan helped Galbatorix to steal a dragon hatchling, Shrukan, to replace the one Galbatorix had lost, killing the dragon's original rider in the process. Morzan and Galbatorix then fled together, sealing our doom. You cannot begin to fathom the effect Morzan's betrayal had on Brom until you understand the depth of Brom's affection for him. And when Galbatorix at last revealed himself and the Forsworn killed Brom's dragon, Brom focused all of his anger and pain on the one who he felt was responsible for the destruction of his world, Morzan. Oromis paused, his face grave. Do you know why losing your dragon or vice versa usually kills the survivor?
I can imagine, said Aragorn. He quailed at the thought.
The pain is shock enough, although it isn't always a factor. But what really causes the damage is feeling part of your mind, part of your identity, die. When it happened to Brom, I fear that he went mad for a time. After I was captured and escaped, I brought him to Ellesmere for safety, but he refused to stay, instead marching with our army to the plains of Illyria, where King Evandar was slain.
The confusion then was indescribable. Galbatorix was busy consolidating his power. The dwarves were in retreat. The southwest was a mass of war, as the humans rebelled and fought to create Surda. And we had just lost our king. Driven by his desire for vengeance, Brom sought to use the turmoil to his advantage. He gathered together many of those who had been exiled, freed some who had been imprisoned, and with them he formed the Varden. He led them for a few years, then surrendered the position to another, so that he was free to pursue his true passion, which was Morzan's downfall. Brom personally killed 3 of the Forsworn, including Morzan, and he was responsible for the deaths of 5 others. He was rarely happy during his life, but he was a good rider and a good man, and I am honoured to have known him.
I never heard his name mentioned in connection to the Forsworn's deaths, objected Aragorn.
Galbatorix did not want to publicise the fact that any still existed who could defeat his servants. Much of his power resides in the appearance of invulnerability.
Once again, Aragorn was forced to revise his conception of Brom, from the village storyteller that Aragorn had first taken him to be, to the warrior and magician he had travelled with, to the rider he was at last revealed as, and now Firebrand, revolutionary leader and assassin. It was hard to reconcile all of those roles.
I feel as if I barely knew him. I wish we had had a chance to talk about all of this at least once.
He was a good man, agreed Aragorn. He looked out one of the round windows that faced the edge of the cliff and allowed the afternoon warmth to suffuse the room. He watched Zephira, noting how she acted with Gleda, seeming both shy and coy. One moment she would twist around to examine some feature of the clearing, the next she would shuffle her wings and make small advances on the larger dragon, weaving her head from side to side, the tip of her tail twitching as if she were about to pounce on a deer. She reminded Aragorn of a kitten trying to bait an old tomcat into playing with her. Only Gleda remained impassive throughout her machinations.
Zephira, he said.
She responded with a distracted flicker of her thoughts, barely acknowledging him.
Zephira, answer me!
What?
I know you're excited, but don't make a fool of yourself.
You've made a fool of yourself plenty of times, she snapped.
Her reply was so unexpected it stunned him. It was the sort of casually cruel remark that humans often make, but that he had never thought to hear from her. He finally managed to say,
That doesn't make it any better.
She grunted and closed her mind to his, although he could still feel the thread of her emotions connecting them. Aragorn returned to himself to find Oromus's grey eyes heavy upon him. The elf's gaze was so perceptive, Aragorn was sure that Oromus understood what had transpired. Aragorn forced a smile and motioned toward Zephira.
Even though we're linked, I can never predict what she's going to do. The more I learn about her, the more I realize how different we are.
Then Oromus made his first statement that Aragorn thought was truly wise.
Those whom we love are often the most alien to us. The elf paused. She is very young, as are you. It took Gleda and I decades before we fully understood each other. A rider's bond with his dragon is like any relationship, that is, a work in progress. Do you trust her?
With my life.
And does she trust you?
Yes.
Then humour her. You were brought up as an orphan. She was brought up to believe that she was the last sane individual of her entire race, and now she has been proved wrong. Don't be surprised if it takes some months before she stops pestering Gleda and returns her attention to you.
Aragorn rolled a blueberry between his thumb and forefinger. His appetite had vanished.
Why don't elves eat meat?
Why should we?
Oromus held up a strawberry and rotated it, so that the light reflected off its dimpled skin and illuminated the tiny hairs that bearded the fruit.
Everything that we need or want we sing from the plants, including our food. It would be barbaric to make animals suffer that we might have additional courses on the table.
Our choice will make greater sense to you before long."
Aragorn frowned. He had always eaten meat and did not look forward to living solely on fruit and vegetables while in Ellesmere. "Don't you miss the taste?"
"You cannot miss that which you have never had."
"What about Gleyda, though? He can't live off grass."
"No, but neither does he needlessly inflict pain. We each do the best we can with what we are given. You cannot help who or what you are born as."
"And Islanzadi? Her cape was made of swan feathers."
"Loose feathers gathered over the course of many years. No birds were killed to make her garment."
They finished the meal, and Aragorn helped Oromis to scour the dishes clean with sand. As the elf stacked them in the cupboard, he asked,
"Did you bathe this morning?"
The question startled Aragorn, but he answered that no, he had not.
"Please do so tomorrow, then, and every day following."
"Every day? The water's too cold for that. I'll catch the ague." Oromis eyed him oddly.
"Then make it warmer."
Now it was Aragorn's turn to look askance. "I'm not strong enough to heat an entire stream with magic," he protested. The house echoed as Oromis laughed. Outside, Gleyda swung his head toward the window and inspected the elf, then returned to his earlier position.
"I assume that you explored your quarters last night?"
Aragorn nodded.
"And you saw a small room with a depression in the floor?"
"I thought that it might be for washing clothes or linens."
"It is for washing you. Two nozzles are concealed in the side of the wall above the hollow. Open them, and you can bathe in water of any temperature. Also," he gestured at Aragorn's chin, "while you are my student, I expect you to keep yourself clean-shaven until you can grow a full beard, if you so choose, and not look like a tree with half its leaves blown off. Elves do not shave, but I will have a razor and mirror found and sent to you."
Wincing at the blow to his pride, Aragorn agreed. They returned outside, whereupon Oromis looked at Gleyda, and the dragon said,
"We have decided upon a curriculum for Saphira and you."
The elf said,
"You will start
1 hour after sunrise tomorrow, in the time of the red lily. Return here, then."
"And bring the saddle that Brom made for you, Saphira," continued Oromis. "Do what you wish in the meantime. Ellesmere holds many wonders for a foreigner, if you care to see them."
"I'll keep that in mind," said Aragorn, bowing his head. "Before I go, Master, I want to thank you for helping me in Trondheim after I killed Durza. I doubt that I would have survived without your assistance. I am in your debt."
"We are both in your debt,"
added Saphira. Oromis smiled slightly and inclined his head.
The Secret Lives of Ants.
The moment that Oromis and Gleyda were out of sight, Saphira said,
"Aragorn, another dragon! Can you believe it?"
He patted her shoulder.
"It's wonderful."
High above Duweldenvarden, the only sign of habitation in the forest was an occasional ghostly plume of smoke that rose from the crown of a tree and soon faded into clear air.
"I never expected to encounter another dragon except for Shrukan. Maybe rescue the eggs from Galbatorix, yes, but that was the extent of my hopes. And now this!"
She wriggled underneath him with joy.
"Gleyda is incredible, isn't he? He's so old and strong, and his scales are so bright. He must be 3 times bigger than me. Did you see his claws? They..."
She continued on in that manner for several minutes, waxing eloquent about Gleyda's attributes. But stronger than her words were the emotions Aragorn sensed roiling within her, eagerness and enthusiasm, twined over what he could only identify as a longing adoration. Aragorn tried to tell Saphira what he had learned from Oromis, since he knew that she had not paid attention, but he found it impossible to change the subject of conversation. He sat silently on her back, the world an emerald ocean below, and felt himself the loneliest man in existence. Back at their quarters, Aragon decided against any sightseeing. He was far too tired from the day's events and the weeks of travelling, and Saphira was more than content to sit on her bed and chatter about Glada while he examined the mysteries of the elves' wash-closet. Morning came, and with it a package wrapped in onion-skin paper containing the razor and mirror that Oromis had promised. The blade was of elvish make, so it needed no sharpening or stropping. Grimacing, Aragon first bathed in steaming hot water, then held up the mirror and confronted his visage. I look older, older and worn. Not only that, but his features had become far more angled, giving him an ascetic, hawk-like appearance. He was no elf, but neither would anyone take him to be a pure-bred human if they inspected him closely. Pulling back his hair, he bared his ears, which now tapered to slight points, more evidence of how his bond with Saphira had changed him. He touched one ear, letting his fingers wander over the unfamiliar shape. It was difficult for him to accept the transformation of his flesh, even though he had known it would occur, and occasionally welcomed the prospect as the last confirmation that he was a rider. The reality of it filled him with confusion. He resented the fact that he had no say in how his body was being altered, yet at the same time he was curious where the process would take him. Also, he was aware that he was still in the midst of his own human adolescence, and its attendant realm of mysteries and difficulties. When will I finally know who and what I am? He placed the edge of the razor against his cheek, as he had seen Garrow do, and dragged it across his skin. The hairs came free, but they were cut long and ragged. He altered the angle of the blade and tried again with a bit more success. When he reached his chin, though, the razor slipped in his hand and cut him from the corner of his mouth to the underside of his jaw. He howled and dropped the razor, clapping his hand over the incision, which poured blood down his neck. Spitting the words past bared teeth, he said, "Waze heal!" The pain quickly receded as magic knitted his flesh back together, though his heart still pounded from the shock.
"Aragon!" cried Saphira.
She forced her head and shoulders into the vestibule and nosed open the door to the closet, flaring her nostrils at the scent of blood.
"I'll live," he assured her.
She eyed the sanguine water.
"Be more careful. I'd rather you were as ragged as a molting deer than have you decapitate yourself for the sake of a close shave."
"So would I. Go on, I'm fine."
Saphira grunted and reluctantly withdrew. Aragon sat glaring at the razor. Finally, he muttered, "Forget this." Composing himself, he reviewed his store of words from the ancient language, selected those that he needed, and then allowed his invented spell to roll off his tongue. A faint stream of black powder fell from his face as his stubble crumbled into dust, leaving his cheeks perfectly smooth. Satisfied, Aragon went and saddled Saphira, who immediately took to the air, aiming their course toward the crags of Telnair. They landed before the hut and were met by Oromis and Glada. Oromis examined Saphira's saddle, pausing on the stitching and buckles, and then pronounced it passable handiwork, considering how and when it had been constructed.
"Brom was always clever with his hands. Use this saddle when you must travel with great speed. But when comfort is allowed..."
He stepped into his hut for a moment and reappeared carrying a thick, moulded saddle decorated with gilt designs along the seat and leg pieces.
"Use this. It was crafted in Vroengard and imbued with many spells so that it will never fail you in time of need."
Aragon staggered under the weight of the saddle as he received it from Oromis. It had the same general shape as Brom's, with a row of buckles intended to immobilize his legs hanging from each side. The deep seat was sculpted out of the leather in such a way that he could fly for hours with ease, both sitting upright and lying flat against Saphira's neck. Also, the straps encircling Saphira's chest were rigged with slips and knots so that they could extend to accommodate years of growth. A series of broad ties on either side of the head of the saddle caught Aragon's attention. He asked their purpose. Glader rumbled,
"Those secure your wrists and arms, so that you are not killed like a rat shaken to death when Saphira performs a complex maneuver."
Oromis helped Aragon relieve Saphira of her current saddle.
"Saphira, you will go with Glader today, and I will work with Aragon here."
"As you wish,"
she said, and crowed with excitement. Heaving his golden bulk off the ground, Glader soared off to the north, Saphira close behind. Oromis did not give Aragon long to ponder Saphira's departure. The elf marched him to a square of hard-packed dirt beneath a willow tree at the far side of the clearing. Standing opposite him in the square, Oromis said,
"What I am about to show you is called the Rimgar, or the Dance of Snake and Crane. It is a series of poses that we developed to prepare our warriors for combat, although all elves use it now to maintain their health and fitness. The Rimgar consists of four levels, each more difficult than the last. We will start with the first." Apprehension for the coming ordeal sickened Aragon to the point where he could barely move. He clenched his fists and hunched his shoulders, his scar tugging at the skin of his back as he glared between his feet.
"Relax," advised Oromis.
Aragon jerked open his hands and let them hang limply at the end of his rigid arms.
"I asked you to relax, Aragon. You can't do the Rimgar if you are as stiff as a piece of rawhide."
"Yes, master."
Aragon grimaced and reluctantly loosened his muscles and joints, although a knot of tension remained coiled in his belly.
"Place your feet together and your arms at your sides. Look straight ahead. Now take a deep breath and lift your arms over your head so that your palms meet. Yes, like that. Exhale and bend down as far as you can. Put your palms on the ground. Take another breath. And jump back. Good. Breathe in and bend up, looking toward the sky. And exhale, lifting your hips until you form a triangle. Breathe in through the back of your throat. And out. In. And out. In."
To Aragon's utter relief, the stances proved gentle enough to hold without igniting the pain in his back, yet challenging enough that sweat beaded his forehead and he panted for breath. He found himself grinning with joy at his reprieve. His wariness evaporated and he flowed through the postures, most of which far exceeded his flexibility, with more energy and confidence than he had possessed since before the battle in Fardandur.
"Maybe I've healed."
Oromis performed the Rimgar with him, displaying a level of strength and flexibility that astounded Aragon, especially for one so old. The elf could touch his forehead to his toes. Throughout the exercise, Oromis remained impeccably composed, as if he were doing no more than strolling down a garden path. His instruction was calmer and more patient than Brom's, yet completely unyielding. No deviation was allowed from the correct path.
"Let us wash the sweat from our limbs," said Oromis when they finished.
Going to the stream by the house, they quickly disrobed. Aragon surreptitiously watched the elf, curious as to what he looked like without his clothes. Oromis was very thin, yet his muscles were perfectly defined, etched under his skin with the hard lines of a woodcut. No hair grew upon his chest or legs, not even around his groin. His body seemed almost freakish to Aragon, compared to the men he was used to seeing in Carvajal, although it had a certain refined elegance to it, like that of a wildcat. When they were clean, Oromis took Aragon deep into Duweldenvarden, to a hollow where the dark trees leaned inward, obscuring the sky behind branches and veils of snarled lichen. Their feet sank into the moss above their ankles. All was silent about them. Pointing to a white stump with a flat, polished top 3 yards across that rested in the centre of the hollow, Aramis said,
"Sit here."
Aragorn did as he was told.
"Cross your legs and close your eyes."
The world went dark around him. From his right, he heard Aramis whisper,
"Open your mind, Aragorn. Open your mind and listen to the world around you, to the thoughts of every being in this glade, from the ants in the trees to the worms in the ground. Listen until you can hear them all and you understand their purpose and nature. Listen, and when you hear no more, come tell me what you have learned." Then the forest was quiet.
Unsure if Aramis had left, Aragorn tentatively lowered the barriers around his mind and reached out with his consciousness, like he did when trying to contact Saphira at a great distance. Initially, only a void surrounded him, but then pricks of light and warmth began to appear in the darkness, strengthening until he sat in the midst of a galaxy of swirling constellations, each bright point representing a life. Whenever he had contacted other beings with his mind, like Cadoc, Snowfire, or Solombum, the focus had always been on the one he wanted to communicate with. But this was as if he had been standing deaf in the midst of a crowd, and now he could hear the rivers of conversation whirling around him. He felt suddenly vulnerable. He was completely exposed to the world. Anyone or anything that might want to leap into his mind and control him could now do so. He tensed unconsciously, withdrawing back into himself, and his awareness of the hollow vanished. Remembering one of Aramis's lessons, Aragorn slowed his breathing and monitored the sweep of his lungs until he had relaxed enough to reopen his mind. Of all the lives he could sense, the majority were, by far, insects. Their sheer number astounded him. Tens of thousands dwelled in a square foot of moss, teeming millions throughout the rest of the small hollow, and uncounted masses beyond. Their abundance actually frightened Aragorn. He had always known that humans were scarce and beleaguered in Alagaesia, but he had never imagined that they were so outnumbered by even beetles. Since they were one of the few insects that he was familiar with and Aramis had mentioned them, Aragorn concentrated his attention on the columns of red ants marching across the ground and up the stems of a wild rosebush. What he gleaned from them were not so much thoughts, their brains were too primitive, but urges. The urge to find food and avoid injury, the urge to defend one's territory, the urge to mate. By examining the ants' instincts, he could begin to puzzle out their behaviour. It fascinated him to discover that except for the few individuals exploring outside the borders of their province, the ants knew exactly where they were going. He was unable to ascertain what mechanism guided them, but they followed clearly defined paths from their nest to food and back. Their source of food was another surprise. As he had expected, the ants killed and scavenged other insects, but most of their efforts were directed toward the cultivation of something that dotted the rosebush. Whatever the life form was, it was barely large enough for him to sense. He focused all of his strength on it in an attempt to identify it and satisfy his curiosity. The answer was so simple, he laughed out loud when he comprehended it. Aphids! The ants were acting as shepherds for aphids, driving and protecting them, as well as extracting sustenance from them by massaging the aphids' bellies with the tips of their antennae. Aragorn could hardly believe it, but the longer he watched, the more he became convinced that he was correct. He traced the ants underground into their complex matrix of warrens and studied how they cared for a certain member of their species that was several times bigger than a normal ant. However, he was unable to determine the insect's purpose. All he could see were servants swarming around it, rotating it, and removing the specks of matter it produced at regular intervals. After a time, Aragorn decided that he had gleaned all the information from the ants that he could, unless he was willing to sit there for the rest of the day, and was about to return to his body when a squirrel jumped into the glade.
Its appearance was like a blast of light to him, attuned as he was to the insects. Stunned, he was overwhelmed by a rush of sensations and feelings from the animal. He smelled the forest with its nose, felt the bark give under his hooked claws, and the air swish through his upraised plume of a tail. Compared to an ant, the squirrel burned with energy and possessed unquestionable intelligence. Then it leaped to another branch and faded from his awareness. The forest seemed much darker and quieter than before when Aragorn opened his eyes. He took a deep breath and looked about, appreciating for the first time how much life existed in the world. Unfolding his cramped legs, he walked over to the rosebush. He bent down and examined the branches and twigs. Sure enough, aphids and their crimson guardians clung to them, and near the base of the plant was the mound of pine needles that marked the entrance to the ant's lair. It was strange to see with his own eyes. None of it betrayed the numerous and subtle interactions that he was now aware of. Engrossed in his thoughts, Aragorn returned to the clearing, wondering what he might be crushing under his feet with every step. When he emerged from under the tree's shelter, he was startled by how far the sun had fallen. "I must have been sitting there for at least 3 hours." He found Oromis in his hut, writing with a goose-feather quill. The elf finished his line, then wiped the nib of the quill clean, stoppered his ink, and asked,
"And what did you hear, Aragorn?"
Aragorn was eager to share. As he described his experience, he heard his voice rise with enthusiasm over the details of the ant society. He recounted everything that he could recall, down to the minutest and most inconsequential observation, proud of the information that he had gathered. When he had finished, Oromis raised an eyebrow.
"Is that all?"
"I..." Dismay gripped Aragorn, as he understood that he had somehow missed the point of the exercise. "Yes, Eberithil."
"And what about the other organisms in the earth and the air? Can you tell me what they were doing while your ants tended their droves?"
"No, Eberithil."
"Therein lies your mistake. You must become aware of all things equally, and not blinker yourself in order to concentrate on a particular subject. This is an essential lesson, and until you master it, you will meditate on the stump for an hour each day."
"How will I know when I have mastered it?"
"When you can watch one and know all."
Oromis mentioned for Aragorn to join him at the table, then set a fresh sheet of paper before him, along with a quill and a bottle of ink.
"So far you have made do with an incomplete knowledge of the ancient language. Not that any of us knows all the words in the language, but you must be familiar with its grammar and structure, so that you do not kill yourself through an incorrectly placed verb or similar mistake. I do not expect you to speak our language like an elf, that would take a lifetime. But I do expect you to achieve unconscious competence. That is, you must be able to use it without thinking. In addition, you must learn to read and write the ancient language. Not only will this help you to memorize words, it is an essential skill if you need to compose an especially long spell and you don't trust your memory, or if you find such a spell recorded and you want to use it. Every race has evolved their own system of writing the ancient language. The dwarves use their runic alphabet, as do humans. They are only makeshift techniques, though, and are incapable of expressing the language's true subtleties as well as our Lidwen Kvadi, the poetic script. The Lidwen Kvadi was designed to be as elegant, beautiful, and precise as possible. It is composed of 42 different shapes that represent various sounds. These shapes can be combined in a nearly infinite range of glyphs that represent both individual words and entire phrases. The symbol on your ring is one such glyph. The symbol on Zarok is another. Let us start. What are the basic vowel sounds of the ancient language?"
"What?"
Aragorn's ignorance of the underpinnings of the ancient language quickly became apparent. When he had travelled with Brom, the old storyteller had concentrated on having Aragorn memorize lists of words that he might need to survive,
as well as perfecting his pronunciation. In those two areas he excelled, but he could not even explain the difference between a definite and indefinite article. If the gaps in his education frustrated Aramis, the elf did not betray it through word or action, but laboured persistently to mend them. At a certain point during the lesson, Aragon commented, "I've never needed very many words in my spells. Brom said it was a gift that I could do so much with just Brisinger. I think the most I ever said in the ancient language was when I spoke to Arya in her mind, and when I blessed an orphan in Fardendur."
"You blessed a child in the ancient language?" asked Aramis, suddenly alert. "Do you remember how you worded this blessing?"
"Aye."
"Recite it for me."
Aragon did so, and a look of pure horror engulfed Aramis. He exclaimed,
"You used scholar. Are you sure? Wasn't it scholaro?"
Aragon frowned. "No, scholar. Why shouldn't I have used it? Scholar means shielded. And may you be shielded from misfortune. It was a good blessing."
"That was no blessing, but a curse."
Aramis was more agitated than Aragon had ever seen him.
"The suffix o forms the past tense of verbs ending with r and I. Scholaro means shielded, but scholar means shield. What you said was, may luck and happiness follow you, and may you be a shield from misfortune. Instead of protecting this child from the vagaries of fate, you condemned her to be a sacrifice for others, to absorb their misery and suffering so that they might live in peace."
"No, no, it can't be."
Aragon recoiled from the possibility.
"The effect a spell has isn't only determined by the word sense, but also by your intent, and I didn't intend to harm—"
"You cannot gainsay a word's inherent nature. Twist it, yes, guide it, yes, but not contravene its definition to imply the very opposite."
Aramis pressed his fingers together and stared at the table, his lips reduced to a flat white line.
"I will trust that you did not mean harm, else I would refuse to teach you further. If you were honest and your heart was pure, then this blessing may cause less evil than I fear, though it will still be the nucleus of more pain than either of us could wish."
Violent trembling overtook Aragon as he realized what he had done to the child's life. "It may not undo my mistake," he said, "but perhaps it will alleviate it. Saphira marked the girl on the brow, just like she marked my palm, with the Gedwe Ignazia." For the first time in his life, Aragon witnessed an elf dumbstruck. Aramis's grey eyes widened, his mouth opened, and he clutched the arms of his chair until the wood groaned with protest.
"One who bears the sign of the riders, and yet is not a rider," he murmured. "In all my years I have never met anyone such as the two of you. Every decision you make seems to have an impact far beyond what anyone could anticipate. You change the world with your whims."
"Is that good or bad?"
"Neither. It just is. Where is the babe now?"
It took a moment for Aragon to compose his thoughts. "With the Varden, either in Fardendur or Surda. Do you think that Saphira's mark will help her?"
"I know not. No precedent exists to draw upon for wisdom."
"There must be ways to remove the blessing, to negate a spell." Aragon was almost pleading.
"There are. But for them to be most effective, you should be the one to apply them, and you cannot be spared here. Even under the best of circumstances, remnants of your magic will haunt this girl evermore. Such is the power of the ancient language."
He paused.
"I see that you understand the gravity of the situation, so I will say this only once. You bear full responsibility for this girl's doom, and because of the wrong you did her, it is incumbent upon you to help her, if ever the opportunity should arise. By the rider's law, she is your shame as surely as if you had begotten her out of wedlock, a disgrace among humans, if I remember correctly."
"Aye," whispered Aragon, "I understand." I understand that I forced a defenseless baby to pursue a certain destiny without ever giving her a choice in the matter. Can someone be truly good if they never have the opportunity to act badly? I made her a slave.
He also knew that if he had been bound in that manner without permission, he would hate his jailer with every fibre of his being.
Then we will speak of this no more.
Yes, Ebrithil.
Aragorn was still subdued, even depressed, by the end of the day. He barely looked up when they went outside to meet Saphira and Gleda upon their return. The trees shook from the fury of the gale that the two dragons created with their wings. Saphira seemed proud of herself. She arched her neck and pranced towards Aragorn, opening her chops in a lupine grin. A stone cracked under Gleda's weight as the ancient dragon turned a giant eye as large as a dinner platter on Aragorn and asked,
"What are the rules, three, to spotting downdrafts, and the rules, five, for escaping them?"
Startled out of his reverie, Aragorn could only blink dumbly.
"I don't know."
Then Oromis confronted Saphira and asked,
"What creatures do ants farm, and how do they extract food from them?"
"I wouldn't know,"
declared Saphira. She sounded affronted. A gleam of anger leaped into Oromis's eyes, and he crossed his arms, though his expression remained calm.
"After all the two of you have done together, I would think that you had learned the most basic lesson of being Surtugal. Share everything with your partner. Would you cut off your right arm? Would you fly with only one wing? Never. Then why would you ignore the bond that links you? By doing so, you reject your greatest gift and your advantage over any single opponent. Nor should you just talk to each other with your minds, but rather mingle your consciousnesses until you act and think as one. I expect both of you to know what either one of you is taught."
"What about our privacy?" objected Aragorn.
"Privacy," said Gleda. "Keep your thoughts to thyself when you leave here, if it pleases you. But while we tutor you, you have no privacy."
Aragorn looked at Saphira, feeling even worse than before. She avoided his gaze, then stamped her foot and faced him directly.
"What?"
"They're right. We have been negligent."
"It's not my fault."
"I didn't say that it was."
She had guessed his opinion, though. He resented the attention she lavished on Gleda and how it drew her away from him.
"We'll do better, won't we?"
"Of course,"
she snapped. She declined to offer Oromis and Gleda an apology, though, leaving the task to Aragorn.
"We won't disappoint you again."
"See that you don't. You will be tested tomorrow on what the other learned."
Oromis revealed a round wood bauble nestled in the middle of his palm.
"So long as you take care to wind it regularly, this device will wake you at the proper time each morning. Return here as soon as you have bathed and eaten."
The bauble was surprisingly heavy when Aragorn took it. The size of a walnut, it had been carved with deep whorls around a knob wrought in the likeness of a moss rose blossom. He turned the knob experimentally and heard three clicks as a hidden ratchet advanced.
"Thank you," he said.
Under the Manoa Tree. After Aragorn and Saphira had said their farewells, they flew back to their treehouse, with Saphira's new saddle dangling between her front claws. Without acknowledging the fact, they gradually opened their minds and allowed their connection to widen and deepen, though neither of them consciously reached for the other. Aragorn's tumultuous emotions must have been strong enough for Saphira to sense anyway, though, for she asked,
"What happened then?"
A throbbing pain built up behind his eyes as he explained the terrible crime he had committed in Fardan Dûr. Saphira was as appalled by it as he was. He said, "Your gift may help that girl, but what I did is inexcusable and will only hurt her."
"The blame isn't all yours. I share your knowledge of the ancient language, and I didn't spot the error any more than you did.
When Aragorn remained silent, she added,
At least your back didn't cause any trouble today. Be grateful for that.
He grunted, unwilling to be tempted out of his black mood. And what did you learn this fine day?
How to identify and avoid dangerous weather patterns.
She paused, apparently ready to share the memories with him, but he was too busy worrying about his distorted blessing to inquire further. Nor could he bear the thought of being so intimate right then. When he did not pursue the matter, Saphira withdrew into a taciturn silence. Back in their bedroom, he found a tray of food by the screen door as he had the previous night. Carrying the tray to his bed, which had been remade with fresh linens, he settled down to eat, cursing the lack of meat. Already sore from the Rimgar, he propped himself up with pillows and was about to take his first bite when there came a gentle rapping at the opening to his chamber.
Enter, he growled.
He took a drink of water. Aragorn nearly choked as Arya stepped through the doorway. She had abandoned the leather clothes she usually wore in favour of a soft green tunic cinched at the waist with a girdle adorned with moonstones. She had also removed her customary headband, allowing her hair to tumble around her face and over her shoulders. The biggest change, however, was not so much in her dress but her bearing. The brittle tension that had permeated her demeanour ever since Aragorn first met her was now gone. She seemed to have finally relaxed. He scrambled to his feet, noticing that her own were bare.
Arya, why are you here?
Touching her first two fingers to her lips, she said,
Do you plan on spending another evening inside? You have been in Ellesmere for 3 days now, and yet you have seen nothing of our city. I know that you always wished to explore it. Set aside your weariness this once, and accompany me.
Gliding toward him, she took Zarok from where it lay by his side and beckoned to him. He rose from the bed and followed her into the vestibule, where they descended through the trapdoor and down the precipitous staircase that wound around the rough tree trunk. Overhead, the gathering clouds glowed with the sun's last rays before it was extinguished behind the edge of the world. A piece of bark fell on Aragorn's head, and he looked up to see Saphira leaning out of their bedroom, gripping the wood with her claws. Without opening her wings, she sprang into the air and dropped the 100 or so feet to the ground, landing in a thunderous cloud of dirt.
I'm coming.
Of course, said Arya, as if she expected nothing less.
Aragorn scowled. He had wanted to be alone with her, but he knew better than to complain. They walked under the trees, where dusk already extended its tendrils from inside hollow logs, dark crevices in boulders, and the underside of knobby eaves. Here and there, a gem-like lantern twinkled within the side of a tree or at the end of a branch, casting gentle pools of light on either side of the path. Elves worked on various projects in and around the lantern's radius, solitary, except for a few rare couples. Several elves sat high in the trees, playing mellifluous tunes on their reed pipes, while others stared at the sky with peaceful expressions, neither awake nor asleep. One elf sat cross-legged before a pottery wheel that whirled round and round with a steady rhythm, while a delicate urn took form beneath his hands. The weircat, Maud, crouched beside him in the shadows, watching his progress. Her eyes flared silver as she looked at Aragorn and Saphira. The elf followed her gaze and nodded to them without halting his work. Through the trees, Aragorn glimpsed an elf, man or woman he could not tell, squatting on a rock in the middle of a stream, muttering a spell over the orb of glass clutched in its hands. He twisted his neck in an attempt to get an unobstructed view, but the spectacle had already vanished into the dark. What? Asked Aragorn, keeping his voice low so as not to disturb anyone. Do most elves do for a living or profession?
Arya answered just as quietly. Our strength with magic grants us as much leisure as we desire. We neither hunt nor farm, and as a result we spend our days working to master our interests, whatever they might be. Very little exists that we must strive for. Through a tunnel of dogwood draped with creepers, they entered the enclosed atrium of a house grown out of a ring of trees. An open walled hut occupied the centre of the atrium, which sheltered a forge, and an assortment of tools that Aragorn knew even Horst would covet. An elf woman held a pair of small tongs in a nest of molten coals, working bellows with her right hand. With uncanny speed, she pulled the tongs from the fire, revealing a ring of white-hot steel clamped in the pincer's jaws, looped the ring through the edge of an incomplete mail corselet hung over the anvil, grasped a hammer, and welded shut the open ends of the ring with a blow and a burst of sparks. Only then did Arya approach.
"Atra esterni ono telduin."
The elf faced them, her neck and cheek lit from underneath by the coal's bloody light. Like taut wires embedded in her skin, her face was scribed with a delicate pattern of lines, the greatest display of age Aragorn had seen in an elf. She gave no response to Arya, which he knew was offensive and discourteous, especially since the queen's daughter had honoured her by speaking first.
"Runon Elder, I have brought you the newest rider, Aragorn Shadeslayer."
"I heard you with Date,"
said Runon to Arya. Runon's voice guttered and rasped, unlike any other elf's. It reminded Aragorn of the old men of Carvajal, who sat on the porches outside their houses, smoking pipes and telling stories. Arya smiled.
"When did you last leave your house, Runon?"
"You should know. It was that Midsummer's feast you forced me to attend."
"That was 3 years ago."
"Was it?"
Runon frowned as she banked the coals and covered them with a grated lid.
"Well, what of it? I find company trying. A gaggle of meaningless chatter that..."
She glared at Arya.
"Why are we speaking this foul language? I suppose you want me to forge a sword for him. You know I swore to never create instruments of death again. Not after that traitor of a rider and the destruction he wreaked with my blade."
"Aragorn already has a sword," said Arya.
She raised her arm and presented Zarok to the smith. Runon took Zarok with a look of wonder. She caressed the wine-red sheath, lingered on the black symbol etched into it, rubbed a bit of dirt from the hilt, then wrapped her fingers around the handle and drew the sword with all the authority of a warrior. She sighted down each of Zarok's edges and flexed the blade between her hands until Aragorn feared it might break. Then, in a single movement, Runon swung Zarok over her head and brought it down upon the tongs on her anvil, riving them in half with a resounding ring.
"Zarok," said Runon, "I remember thee."
She cradled the weapon like a mother would her firstborn.
"As perfect as the day you were finished."
Turning her back, she looked up at the knotted branches while she traced the curves of the pommel.
"My entire life I spent hammering these swords out of ore. Then he came and destroyed them. Centuries of effort obliterated in an instant. So far as I knew, only 4 examples of my art still existed. His sword, Oromis's, and 2 others guarded by families who managed to rescue them from the Weirdfell."
"Weirdfell?"
Aragorn dared ask Arya with his mind.
"Another name for the Forsworn."
Runon turned on Aragorn.
"Now Zarok has returned to me. Of all my creations, this I least expected to hold again, save for his. How came you to possess Morzan's sword?"
"It was given to me by Brom."
"Brom?"
She hefted Zarok.
"Brom. I remember Brom. He begged me to replace the sword he had lost. Truly, I wished to help him, but I had already taken my oath. My refusal angered him beyond reason. Oromis had to knock him unconscious before he would leave."
Aragorn seized on the information with interest.
"Your handiwork has served me well, Runon Elder. I would be long dead were it not for Zarok. I killed the Shade Durza with it."
"Did you now? Then some good has come of it."
Sheathing Zarok, Runon returned it to him, though not without reluctance, then looked past him to Saphira.
"Ah, well met, Skurblaka."
"Well met, Runon Elder."
Without bothering to ask permission, Runon went up to Saphira's shoulder and tapped a scale with one of her blunt fingernails, twisting her head from side to side in an attempt to peer into the translucent pebble.
"Good colour. Not like those brown dragons, all muddy and dark. Properly speaking, a rider's sword should match the hue of his dragon, and this blue would have made a gorgeous blade.
The thought seemed to drain the energy from her. She returned to the anvil and stared at the wrecked tongs, as if the will to replace them had deserted her. Aragorn felt that it would be wrong to end the conversation on such a depressing note, but he could not think of a tactful way to change the subject. The glimmering corselet caught his attention, and as he studied it, he was astonished to see that every ring was welded shut. Because the tiny links cooled so quickly, they usually had to be welded before being attached to the main piece of mail, which meant that the finest mail, such as Aragorn's hauberk, was composed of links that were alternately welded and riveted closed. Unless, it seemed, the smith possessed an elf's speed and precision. Aragorn said, "I've never seen the equal of your mail, not even among the dwarves. How do you have the patience to weld every link? Why don't you just use magic and save yourself the work?" He hardly expected the burst of passion that animated Runon. She tossed her short cropped hair and said,
"And rob myself of all pleasure in this task? Aye, every other elf and I could use magic to satisfy our desires, and some do. But then what meaning is there in life? How would you fill your time? Tell me."
"I don't know," he confessed.
"By pursuing that which you love the most. When you can have anything you want by uttering a few words, the goal matters not, only the journey to it. A lesson for you. You'll face the same dilemma one day, if you live long enough. Now be gone. I am weary of this talk."
With that, Runon plucked the lid off the forge, retrieved a new pair of tongs, and immersed a ring in the coals while she worked the bellows with single-minded intensity. "Runon Elder," said Arya, "remember, I will return for you on the eve of the Agaiti Blodron." A grunt was her only reply. The rhythmic peal of steel on steel, as lonely as the cry of a death bird in the night, accompanied them back through the dogwood tunnel and onto the path. Behind them, Runon was no more than a black figure bowed over the sullen glow of her forge. "She made all the rider's swords?" asked Aragorn. "Every last one?" "That and more. She's the greatest smith who has ever lived. I thought you should meet her, for her sake and yours. Thank you."
"Is she always so brusque?"
asked Saphira. Arya laughed. "Always. For her, nothing matters except her craft, and she's famously impatient with anything or anyone that interferes with it. Her eccentricities are well tolerated, though, because of her incredible skill and accomplishments." While she spoke, Aragorn tried to work out the meaning of Agaiti Blodron. He was fairly sure that Blod stood for blood, and as a result that Blodron was blood oath. But he had never heard of Agaiti. "Celebration," explained Arya when he asked. "We hold the blood oath celebration once every century to honour our pact with the dragons. Both of you are fortunate to be here now, for it is nigh upon us." Her slanted eyebrows met as she frowned. "Fate has indeed arranged a most auspicious coincidence." She surprised Aragorn by leading them deeper into Duweldenvarden, down paths tangled with nettles and currant bushes, until the lights around them vanished, and they entered the restless wilderness. In the darkness, Aragorn had to rely on Saphira's keen night vision so as not to lose his way. The craggy trees increased in width, crowding closer and closer together and threatening to form an impenetrable barrier. Just when it appeared that they could go no farther, the forest ended, and they entered a clearing washed with moonlight from the bright sickle low in the eastern sky. A lone pine tree stood in the middle of the clearing. No taller than the rest of its brethren, it was thicker than 100 regular trees combined. In comparison, they looked as puny as windblown saplings. A blanket of roots radiated from the tree's massive trunk, covering the ground with bark-sheathed veins that made it seem as if the entire forest flowed out from the tree, as if it were the heart of Duweldenvarden itself. The tree presided over the woods like a benevolent matriarch, protecting its inhabitants under the shelter of her branches.
"Behold, the Manoa tree," whispered Arya.
we observed the Agaiti Blodron in her shade. A cold tingle crawled down Aragon's side as he recognized the name. After Angela told his fortune in Tirm, Solombum had come up to him and said,